Wow, there's a lot of questions now. I've really stirred people up. Yes, at the back. If you collect good karma, can you drive that bus? No, you can't drive that bus. Even with people with good karma, things go wrong sometimes. It's one of those questions. Sometimes say, this person, they were so generous, they were so good, they kept the five precepts, and had all these things happen to them. Why? Have you seen that in the world? So why does that happen? The Buddha actually gave this simile of the stick. If you toss up a stick, you see this pen here, it's got the ink and the sort of the other end. If I throw up this stick, which end would it drop on? You don't really know. The heavier end, if this was very heavy and weighted, it's more likely it will fall on that end. But it doesn't always fall on that end. Sometimes the stick falls on the light end. By making good karma, you're increasing the chances of happiness. But sometimes, even with good karma, the stick lands on the other end. He said, this is a simile of the stick, which makes you very scared of samsara. Even with good karma, you can't control the world, you just influence it. You make it less likely the bus goes through bad territory. But now and again it will still go through bad territory. Because the stick has two ends. Karma has two ends too. The good end, the bad end. So in the end, the only thing to do is to transcend that karma. That's why enlightenment is the end of all karma. There the karma becomes sometimes what we call a hosi karma. Karma from the past which will never reach you again. You become free of karma. Does that answer the question? It's a deep question. Somebody answer the question. Yes, you had a question. Who's the next one? Go on, yeah. What's the difference between concentration and insight? The answer is that one day, Mrs. Samatha and Mr. Vipassana, who were devoted couple, they were married a long time ago by the Buddha, Mrs. Samatha and Mr. Vipassana decided to go for a walk up on top of a hill. Mrs. Samatha went up there because it was so peaceful and quiet on top of the mountain. But Mr. Vipassana, he went up there for the view. So there was Mrs. Samatha and Mr. Vipassana walking up the mountain together. One going up there for the peace and quiet, the other one going up there for the view. When they got to the top of the mountain, Mrs. Samatha was so happy, was so peaceful up there. But you know, she also noticed the view. And Mr. Vipassana, he saw this gorgeous view. But he also appreciated the peace and quiet up there. You know why? Because on top of the mountain, there is both peace and a view. So it doesn't matter whether you walk up that mountain for the view and think you're doing Vipassana meditation, or if you're walking up that mountain for the peace and quiet, thinking you're doing Samatha meditation. When you get to that top of the mountain, you experience both. Because they coexist in the deep stillness of the mind, in the insight which comes from such stillness. That's the answer to your question. They are the same. My teacher said that again and again. When he'd say, you can see my hand here, you can just see the front of my hand. But I guarantee you the back is right behind. Now you see the back of my hand, but the front is right behind. I cannot split the front and the back of my hand. They always go together. Sometimes you only see one part. Now that you just see Samatha. But I tell you that Vipassana is right behind. Sometimes you just see Vipassana. But I tell you Samatha is right behind. The sign of deep concentration or stillness is the insight which you gain from it. The sign of insight is the calm which it produces. If you have some insight and you're not peaceful afterwards, that is not insight. It's just an idea. So insight is known by the calm it produces. And calm is known by the insight it generates. They always go together. Mrs. Samatha, Mr. Vipassana, married by the Buddha a long time ago. So the next question, I'm going to do some. What is the next step after seeing our body disappear in our meditation? The next step is seeing your will disappear. That's called second jhana. And that is weird. In the second jhana, you cannot move. You know why you can't move, why it's so still? I don't usually use the word concentration anymore. That gives the wrong impression. I call states of still awareness. The deeper the stillness, the deeper the meditation. So that's why the jhanas are deep still awareness. In the second jhana, you are so still, the reason why you're still is because there's nothing left to move you. The potential to do is gone. Now this is much different than just saying, I'm not going to do anything. This is where you can't do anything. You're that still, the will or the potential to do has completely vanished. Earlier today, I told a simile of watching the ocean, seeing things rise and fall, and then suddenly the ocean completely vanishes. This is what I meant. The will, which was always there, has suddenly gone. Only then do you understand what the will is. Once upon a time, there was a little tadpole swimming in the lake. He was a philosophical tadpole. He would listen to all the frogs talk about this amazing state called dry land. But he could never understand dry land. When he asked the frogs, is dry land wet? He said, no, of course it's not wet. Any fishes there? No, there's no fishes in dry land. It was completely beyond his experience. He couldn't understand it at all. Even when he asked what the opposite was, water. Even though he swam in it every day, the tadpole just could not understand what water was. How could you when it's always there? But one day the tadpole grew into a frog himself. And he left the lake for the first time. Ah, now I understand what all these frogs with brown robes and bald heads were talking about. Only now do I understand what water is. In the same way that one day that you will leave the pond of the five senses and the body and go into the realm of mind called jhanas, only then will you know what will is when you've left it behind. The will, like water, has always been there. So you don't know what it is. Once it disappears, ah, now you know what it is. That's what happens in stillness. So the next step after seeing the body disappear, see will, choice, the doer disappear. And the next step after that is seeing the knower disappear. See the mind stop and cease. If you can do that, then you're either an anagami or fully enlightened. Anagami is one stage left. You've seen the emptiness of all things. What you thought was solid is now seen as full of holes. Emptiness. So full of holes, you'll understand why the Buddha called this the holy life. Next question. While I was meditating recently, mind was very quiet and peaceful, but suddenly there appears a hole there, a void. There, you understand why now. You're understanding the holy life. But also, if it's whole, it's a void, what is it void of, and what's left? See what's disappeared, and see what remains. And keep on meditating until everything has disappeared, until nothing at all remains. Until not even nothing. Once a person attains Sotapanna, can he control the bus or the bus driver? No, he's completely out of control. He was always out of control. Now he realizes how out of control he was. No self in there. So the Sotapanna just gives up 7 lifetimes before the bus reaches the terminus. Questions. Is having ego a bad thing? It's not a good thing or a bad thing. It's just a shitty thing. So I'm like, you know, is like, you know, watching soccer a good thing or a bad thing? Is this a silly waste of time? That's all. What do you do it for? It's like playing video games, a bad thing or a good thing? You ask your kids, that's a good thing, it's a good thing. You say, what are you wasting your time on? It's just kids being kids. Watching soccer is just men being men. Just watching the soapies. You have soapies? Yeah. Watching the soapies is a girl thing. It's just girls being girls. And watching the mind is just a monk thing. It's monks being monks. So it's not a good thing or a bad thing. It's just, you know, a thing. If no ego, will one behave like a kid? If you no ego, you behave like a Buddha. And how do we deal with the upset in us when our own pride is being hurt? Say, thank you, thank you, thank you for weakening my pride. You've hurt my pride. So you've weakened it. You've exposed my attachments. Oh, I'm so grateful to you. Thank you so much. Isn't that a wonderful thing to do? Because they're testing you out. It's like a teacher at school. And you've got an error there. And you suffer for it. Oh, thank you. I've found out a weakness there. But all this ego and pride. Now, why do people get into this? It's actually the joke I told the other day about pride. About these four Catholics. And they were in this coffee shop in Western Australia. And they were talking about their sons. Because one of their sons had just been ordained as a Catholic priest. And she was so proud of her son. She said, my son is now a Catholic priest. When he comes into a room, everybody lowers their head and they say respectfully, Father, Father. And she was so proud. The next woman having a coffee, that's nothing. That's ordinary. My son ordained as a priest a long time ago. Now he's a bishop. When he comes into a room, people kneel on their knees on the floor. And they kiss his ring and they call him Your Grace, Your Grace. That's much better than just being an ordinary priest. And the third woman lifts up her nose. Nothing. My son, he's a cardinal. When he comes into a room, everyone falls on the floor and grovels and calls My Eminence or Your Eminence. And they look to the fourth woman who is still finishing her latte. What about your son? And when she finished her latte, she said, My son's not a priest. He's not in holy orders. My son is 6'3", blonde haired, blue eyes, absolutely gorgeous. He's a self-made millionaire. And he plays soccer for Manchester United. When he comes into a room, all the women faint before saying, My God, my God. Okay. So much for respect in religion. So all these egos and pride, thinking you're much better because your son is a footballer or something. Anyway, if marriage is considered as a social or cultural norm, what is the Buddhist perspective of living together or being a second wife or mistress? This person, when I was on Talkback Radio, I forget whether this was in Singapore or Perth, you get on Talkback Radio. It's good fun because people shoot questions to you over the air and lots of people are listening to you, so you have to be very sharp and on the ball. There's a taxi driver rang up and his question was that I'm married, I have a mistress, I'm having an affair, my wife doesn't know about it, is it bad? And my answer was, sir, if it was good, you would not be ringing me up to ask. whoever asked this question, the point is here that living together, or being a second wife or mistress, if it's living together, many people do that these days. And sometimes I see it's a commitment together. For some reason, they don't like the marriage. It may be legal reasons or their parents, or sometimes they think that maybe this, they can still have that commitment but don't need a piece of paper. Sometimes it's a thing which people do these days. And I've seen many, many good relationships that way. So that's a different thing. Even if you don't get married, but you have like a commitment inside, fine. But sometimes I ask, well, why don't you get married anyway? You don't have to go in the church and have all these big things. I could marry you. You know, I'll just give you a religious ceremony. You know, we can actually do some chanting for you and tell you some nice stories. Because I tell people that sometimes a marriage, it really is a commitment. And if you're living together, sometimes it's only an involvement. And I tell the difference with a simile in my book. The difference between a marriage, a commitment, and just going out together, an involvement, is the same as the difference between bacon and eggs. In bacon and eggs, if you think about it, the chicken is only involved, but the pig is committed. The pig has to give its whole life for bacon. Chicken only gives an egg. Got many left over. So if you have a marriage, you have to commit yourself, all of yourself. You don't keep anything back. In an involvement, you keep something back. So if you're married, it's no all in. You give everything. Sometimes people actually do live together without the formal marriage and they still give everything. If that's what you do, fine. But if you're just living together but you're not fully committed, you're holding something back, it will not last. If you're going to have that relationship, you have to give it 100%. But having a mistress, that's not even giving it 100%. It's 50% for her and 50% for my wife, maybe even different proportions. Having a second wife or mistress, why is that question, having a second wife or mistress? Why doesn't anyone ask, what about having a second boyfriend or a second husband? Because that doesn't happen, does it? Women are much more intelligent than that. Be careful, you men. Adultery is bad karma. You create a lot of suffering. But what happens is that, you know, you're married with someone and you see another guy, or another girl in the office or something. Because you're working and people have to dress up when they go to work, and it's attractive, sometimes you lose it. A fantasy, a liking, turns to a lust. When lust comes up, always remember this, lust drives you crazy. You're not in your right mind. And because you have lust for that person, you just can't think straight. All your priorities get scrambled. Which is why that when men have lust for another woman, when they're still married, they always think, they will never get caught, it's okay, I'm just enjoying myself, why not? You can't trust a mind when it has lust. Be careful there, because so many men, as soon as they have lust for a girl who's not their wife, all their ethics get scrambled. They may have been coming to Buddhist Gem Fellowship for years, but they can't see it. They can't see the pain they're causing. And when you do get found out, which eventually you do, and it wrecks your marriage, and it wrecks your kids, and it destroys your family, you say, what have I done? How could I not have seen this? Lust drives you crazy. It's like a madness of the mind. So please be careful. Before it gets that bad, walk away. Take evasive action. Otherwise, you'll be in big trouble. So, second wife or mistress is not a good idea. One woman is enough suffering. Two.
I don't
to apologize. Say, one husband is enough suffering. That's why women are much smarter, weren't you? No. Dear Ajahn, the unconditional love you said earlier, feeling happy when your wife having a good time with your best friend. Does this contradict the fifth precepts? Are we encouraging the violation? This was just a simile, not to be taken seriously. What is your advice to overcome betrayal? Forgiveness. You have to build trust. Someone betrays your trust, give your trust again. Doesn't matter how many times people betray me, I will always trust them. Until such times that people feel, just, why should I betray that person again? That's what I would do. But if you can't stand it, and you know, you're not as spiritually advanced, then you just have to walk away. But try your very best. You can't forgive too much. By forgiving, you're always making really, really good karma. Eventually, you'll get the payoff. Those people who betray are making bad karma. They'll get their payoff eventually. Is there any remedy for a person who has violated one of the five precepts, or the person just has to live with the guilt consciousness? Just forgive, for goodness sake. Doesn't really matter, you've broken the five precepts. There's some bad karma there, but just forgive and learn. What's it like when you break the five precepts? Be honest. If you have had a mistress, quite honest, yeah, it was fun, but don't you feel so guilty that there's another person you're hurting? And you're, what are you teaching your kids by your example? All the times you have to just lie to say why you're late from work or why you have to go somewhere. And all the deceit. And the person you married, you're not honest with. You can't have that trust anymore. What are you doing to your life? You're screwing it up. So if you really reflect on what's happening, you'd never do that. Remember, this monk said, if people would only be wise and know what adultery does, they would never do that, no more than they put their hand in the fire. So that's my answer there. How do you reply to a child when he said, the next life I want to be an animal, no need to worry about homework, etc.? This was said when he's depressed and had to work too much homework. Okay, you should take him to the dog pound. Put him in there for a few days. If you don't want to do that, give him his dinner in a bowl and put a lead on him and take him for a walk in the morning. I'll go through these questions quickly because I'm running out of time. What is Buddhism's point of view for test tube babies, right or wrong, and why? I can't see any reason why not. If a person can't have a baby in the ordinary way, no, it's just you can have in vitro fertilization, nothing wrong with that at all. And sometimes some couples, they try so hard to have a child, they can't do it in one way, they do it in another way. That's fine. No trouble there at all. Since I have a lot of defilements, I have to be born again to suffer. This gives me fear, makes me feel unhappy. I'm getting old and I have not much time to get enlightened, but the Buddha is out of the way for me, please advise. Okay, slow down. So like time is just an illusion. So it doesn't matter how much time it takes. The only time there is now. So make now a peaceful moment. Look at this moment you have now as something most valuable. The most precious thing you have is your life. And that life is what's happening now. So this moment is the most precious thing. If you could only make this moment pure, good, kind, then you're walking on the path to enlightenment. And you can do no more than that. There was my first teacher who was a Thai man, once said that his father gave him some seeds, some flower seeds, to plant in his garden when he was 6 years of age. He put these seeds in the garden and watered them every day. After 6 or 7 days, being a six-year-old, he became impatient. He could see nothing happening. And so he told his father, it's a waste of time, my flowers aren't growing. And his father took his son aside and said, when you plant seeds and water them, they have to germinate first. A small green shoot comes from the seed and pushes its way up. It takes time before it actually pushes its way up into the through the earth and to the surface. Be patient. Soon you'll see a little green shoot coming up. And that was enough encouragement from his father that he kept watering for another week. And as his father had predicted, after 2 weeks he saw this tiny green shoot start to poke up above the surface of the earth. He was so excited, his flowers were finally growing. So he started to water them twice a day. It didn't matter, they still kept growing and growing. When they were about 3 inches high after the third week, that's when he really lost his patience. He decided to stretch them to make them grow faster.